to volunteer to pray. Bill is in here, so
raise his hand.
All right, well, Logan, get us started with a prayer, please.
Heavenly Father, thank you for another day of life. Lord, we thank you for another opportunity to worship you here today, and pray that you'll be with Hunter as he gives us another lesson from your word, and pray that we will take it and apply it to our lives, and we pray that we may be encouraged. Pray in Christ's name. Amen.
Amen. So we are launching into Daniel chapter 7. Before I say anything else, just so you are aware, I didn't say anything last week. This is the live streamed class, so I don't want that to make you hold back from commenting, but just so you're aware that the comments are heard the world round. So, Daniel chapter 7. Do you remember some of the different structural pieces we talked about last week? Where does this chapter fit in the overall structure of the book?
In the middle.
It's right in the middle. Thanks.
It's the second section.
It's in the Aramaic section.
It's the last chapter of the Aramaic section.
So, this begins the second section. There's a pretty clear difference between 1 through 6, which are these narrative stories, and 7 through 12, which are the prophetic visions. But this is also still part of the Aramaic section, which runs from 2 through 7, linking the two halves. So this one has a foot in both worlds. It is in the same language as almost all the stuff that comes before it, but it looks a lot like the stuff that comes after. Do you remember anything else about where this might fit?
It's the back of the book end for the chiasm that makes up that 2 through 7 chiasm.
Yeah, so...
The four kingdoms.
The four plus kingdoms.
Yeah, the four plus one, because you have chapter 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 2 and 7 are parallel, 3 and 6 are parallel, 4 and 5 go together. And these are both involved visions that involve four kingdoms, and then another one. So I wrote 4 plus 1 kingdoms last time. That's the outside of that form. But before we launch into the actual, before we launch into the visions in general, we probably all have a sense of the kinds of things we're about to read. We've got beasts and all sorts of weird imagery and stuff like that that we can get tripped up on. So before we even read it, why do you think God would do it this way? Why use these prophetic visions with this weird imagery instead of just coming out and saying, this is what's about to happen, and then this is what's going to happen, and then this is what's going to happen next? If that's what it means, why not just say that? Why make it harder by using the weird language?
Why did Jesus talk in parables?
You just jumped right to the point. Right to the point. I want to remind you of what Jesus said about his parables in Matthew 13. Because in that context, when he explained, you know, his disciples come and ask, why do you speak in parables? And part of his answer is a quote from Isaiah chapter 6, which is the commissioning of Isaiah. And so he uses this language God gave to Isaiah about Isaiah's job as a prophet to also apply to the parables. So there's a link between the world of the prophets and the world of the parables. So here's what Jesus has to say. Why do you speak to them in parables? Jesus answered them, Matthew 13, 11. To you it has been granted to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been granted. For whoever has, to him more shall be given, and he will have an abundance. But whoever does not have, even what he has, shall be taken away from him. Therefore I speak to them in parables, because while seeing, they do not see. And while hearing, they do not hear, nor do they understand. In their case, the prophecy of Isaiah is being fulfilled, which says, you will keep on hearing, but will not understand. You will keep on seeing, but will not perceive. For the heart of this people has become dull. With their ears they scarcely hear, and they have closed their eyes. Otherwise they would see with their eyes, hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and return. And I would heal them. But blessed are your eyes because they see, and your ears because they hear. How does that help us understand what's going on in the back half of Daniel?
he's giving his vision so that one person can, you know, kind of give a summary to someone else instead of just straight up telling Belshazzar, Nebuchadnezzar, whoever it is, hey, here's what's going to happen to you, here's what's going to happen to your kingdom. He's giving it to someone who he knows will truly understand and truly see what's going on and be able to try to explain it in a better way to someone. So that they see you know, how ridiculous things can be, but in what the truth really is behind it.
Yeah, thank you.
I think as it pertains to this, it's a test of the heart, right? It's do you want to understand? Do you really want to understand? And when you do understand, do you still want to understand? Right? Or will you try to, you know, make it say something different?
Yeah. So I wanted to say all this. Oh, Lauren, go ahead.
Sorry.
You're good.
To Eric's point, I think it's also a result of God having tested their hearts. Because Jesus' words in verse 15, this people's heart has grown callous. Their ears are hard of hearing. I know who you are, and I know where you stand. And so I'm going to make it real easy for you to ignore what's right in front of your face, because I'm going to put it in words that are not easy for you to understand so that you can just walk away, because that's what you've already decided to do.
Yeah. So I think I wanted to say this up front, because as we launch into 7, then even as we, you know, get further into the book and it gets even more difficult, see that the difficulty of this is part of the point, and that it's the challenge here is at least partially intended as sort of a sifting. Do you really want to know this or do you not? And so there will be some work involved to figure some of this out. And Daniel certainly has its challenges where you really got to work to figure some stuff out. So I don't want you to get discouraged as you read, like in preparation for the class or things like that. I don't want you to get discouraged by the challenge of this book. It's challenging for a reason.
And there's also an aspect, though, where I mean, so when Jesus is talking, he's talking to people that are all Jews, to some that have a bad heart and some that have a good heart. And the good heart ones are willing to put in the work to try to understand. In this context, similar to Revelation, there's also going on that you're talking about world events in a time when if you say the wrong thing about the king, you may be a goner. And so some of it's in this way that only somebody who's steeped in this sort of language and this sort of talk would be able to understand, and somebody else would just go, oh, that's, I don't even want to bother trying to figure that out. And they certainly don't see themselves, you know, if Nebuchadnezzar saw himself or Belshazzar saw himself in this, he might be upset. But if he doesn't see himself in it, that's okay. Because the message wasn't really to Belshazzar so much as it is to God's people of here's how you fit into history.
Yeah, so even on a more practical level, this language helps protect the message and the messengers. You don't step on the king's toes if the king doesn't realize that he's a seven-headed beast with all it, you know, whatever it may be.
Revelation was the same, right?
Right. Right, it's the same sort of thing with the Romans and in Revelation. You're talking about them falling. They don't really like to hear that. So, that is part of it too. Thank you. Now, let's get going on it. We're going to break the chapter up into 3 chunks, and I think we'll have time to get to all of it. I hope we do. Daniel chapter 7, beginning at verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. Then he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the 4 winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and 4 great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. And I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind was also given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, resembling a bear. And it was raised up on one side, and 3 ribs were in its mouth between its teeth. And thus they said to it, Arise, devour much meat. After this, I kept looking, and behold, another one, like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and domination was given to it. After this, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong, and it had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And while I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them, and 3 of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it, and behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth uttering great boasts. Okay, let's work that section for a minute. And because there's an explanation later in the chapter, we will leave some of the stuff out, so if we don't get to it, don't worry. What's your immediate reaction to this? What emotions does it stir? What do you think it's meant to convey or to stir?
Fear.
Fear. Yeah. What else?
Awe. There's a lot of, wow. That's impressive.
Yeah. Anything else?
Power.
Good. See, those things just jump right off the page to us. Something else that as I've read about this chapter that was suggested that would be immediately obvious to a Jewish reader who was really familiar with the law is that there may be an element of disgust thrown in here too, because, and this is generally lost on us, and here's why we lost it, but the element of disgust is suggested because these creatures are hybrids in some way, and the law prohibits that. You can't, the Leviticus 19:19 explicitly prohibits breeding different kinds of animals together and different kinds of plants together and things like that. So these hybrid things sort of would carry a level of disgust with it. And that's part of the reason some of the food laws were the way they were, like, you can't eat lobster, it's unclean because it walks and acts like it belongs on land, but it lives in the sea, so it's a weird hybrid, so you can't eat it. That's sort of some of the logic we think we can see in that. So perhaps an element of disgust there too. Now, remember the parallel chapter, chapter 2. That's the vision with the statue, with the different metals and stuff. Use that to help you as we start to pull this apart. So let's work the pieces. First, in verse 2, we get winds stirring up the sea. What do you make of that?
It's like a treacherous situation.
Yeah.
The sea is the chaos.
Yeah. So remember Jeff's sermon a few weeks ago, and he was talking about Jesus coming to them on the water, but that the water is God's realm, and it's scary, and fear, and, you know, all these other things. And perhaps four winds, you know, we have four compass directions, all directions, it's chaos. On top of the sea, this great scary place. And then these beasts come up, and we get the first one. What do you notice about the first one? What do you see there? What do you think it means?
It's a lion with eagle's wings.
What do we do? What do you do with that?
Well, I mean, the lion was the symbol of Babylon, so that may immediately come to mind, especially if we know the gold was, head was Babylon.
Right. And in Scripture, in other, multiple other places, Babylon is explicitly called a lion. So, like, let me give you an example. Jeremiah 50, verse 17. Israel is a scattered flock. The lions have driven them away. The first one who devoured him was the king of Assyria. This last one who has broken his bones is Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, named straight up lion. And you get the same thing with an eagle. In Lamentations 4 and in Habakkuk 1, specific, explicit references to Babylon, also as an eagle. And so with the lion, you get power and might and strength and the usual things. And eagles, usually associated, especially in the Bible, with swiftness. They're quick and they're good at what they do. They're powerful. But what happens to this creature? This is an interesting part of the vision that doesn't come up in the explanation later. So we'll talk about it now.
It loses its wings. It's made to walk like a man.
wings get plucked.
It gets plucked like a chicken, and then it stands up and walks and has a human mind. What's going on?
God is in control.
God is in control, that's the big point. But I think we can actually make something more specific out of this.
I mean, it could go back to Nebuchadnezzar and how he became like a beast of the field, and then, I mean, which was, what, 4 or 5?
He
got plucked from his kingdom.
So at the end of Daniel chapter 4, remember that Nebuchadnezzar is driven away and eats cow like a grass. He's become the beast that he really was.
Eats cow like a grass.
Eats grass like a grass.
Whatever, you know what I mean.
He's not
even. You got all the words there.
The words are all there. Come on now.
Very fitting for the grass.
Yeah.
4:33, immediately the word concerning Nebuchadnezzar was filled, and he was driven away from mankind and began eating grass like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws. But at the end of that period, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes towards heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. And then we get those few verses of praise. So, interesting picture here of what has happened to Nebuchadnezzar. Second beast. Bear. What do you make of it here? Wow. What do you make of this bear?
Another powerful beast.
Another powerful beast. You got anything else?
It just comes and goes quickly, though.
It does come and go quickly. We're really not given much. We're given the picture of this bear raised up on one side. People struggle to really understand exactly what that means, because there is some confusion with the original language there, too. But raised up on one side, whatever that means, it's got ribs in its mouth, and it's told, devour much meat.
Yeah.
So whatever it is, it's going to be powerful and consume a lot.
I think the easy comparison is between the beast that comes before, right? It's actually given the mind of a man, whereas this one is walking on its hind legs like a man,
mm-hmm.
right? And so it's not given that same, you know, agency, I guess. It's being told what to do and where to go and how to behave. And so it's kind of just being manipulated and pushed.
Yeah. And then we get this third one. Do you have anything you want to add there? Leopard, wings, foreheads.
Speed.
Now.
Another big cat with bird stuff. So.
Yeah. Another big cat with bird stuff. Before we go to the fourth, notice what is the language with each of these. Oh, go ahead.
So for all of these, I don't have an answer to this, but I think an important detail would be who the audience is.
Mm-hmm.
So are these metaphors meant to be understood by Jewish people? Are they meant to be understood by Babylonian people? Are they meant to be understood far in the future to look in hindsight and realize who was correct and like make connections to these various groups and empires and things like that? So that's just the thing that I'm thinking of is...
Yeah.
How do we look at this? Is this the significance? I mean, like the same way people look at Revelations.
Yeah.
As like, oh, this means this thing for the audience that was intending to read these letters, but it's different to us.
Right.
So that was just what I'm thinking of is...
But we'll say more about that later. That is a little bit of a challenge with this, but I think there's a way to overcome it, and that's what I'll talk about later. Because at the same time, Jews and Babylonians at this point in history, there is some overlap because they've been living in Babylon for decades.
Yeah.
So they absorb.
Is it two Jews in Babylon that would understand this very specific
right.
niche metaphor?
Right.
Who knows?
So that is part of the challenge. We'll say more about that later. Notice some of the language we're given with the first three specifically. With the first one, a human mind was given to it. The second one, it was told, arise, devour much meat. And the sixth, or verse 6, the third, dominion was given to it. Remember the theme of the book that we talked about, being played again.
Well, doesn't, so this, I might be misremembering history, but doesn't Greece specifically split their rule into four? Like they've, like they have a ruler for each region of it. So would that play into the four heads or four wings?
The history people say yes.
I think that's correct.
So if, I mean, if you're talking about swiftness and everything, I mean, you could easily throw, using hindsight, right?
Yeah.
Looking for ways to explain it, but you could easily throw Alexander on here that came, fell within a generation, then immediately got broken up into all these little sub-empires.
Yeah. The fourth. What's different about the description of this one? It says it's dreadful and terrifying.
It's not a specific beast.
The other ones were given a likeness. You know, remember that, you know, it looks like. It's not a lion, but it looks like. This one...
It's the monster under the bed.
Yeah, it's the monster under the bed. We can't even describe it. It's just dreadful and terrifying. There's nothing we can liken this one to. I mean, the only thing we're given specifically about it at this point, it's got iron teeth. And then there's all this weird stuff about horns. And so it's pretty clear that this portion of the chapter, we're given a terrifying, frightful picture. We got this great chaos, these great beasts, and it's kind of scary. If this was the whole dream, you would call this a nightmare. But we must continue. Verse 9. I kept looking until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were a burning fire. And a river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him. And myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat and the books were open. Then I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. And I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming. And he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. What is immediately obvious as we kept reading, thinking about the flow of the whole chapter?
It's in the Masonic.
We're getting there. What's immediately obvious when you get to verse 9, from going from verse 8 to verse 9?
From earth to heaven.
There's a scene change. Things are... This is a different sort of picture. Except the beasts still come up here. So they're still around. We're still working with the same stuff. It's just changed. And we're looking at something different. And so we begin with the Ancient of Days. What do you make of him?
He's in charge.
He is in charge. What do you make of some of the imagery and symbols we're given?
It's pure. The wheels of burning fire remind me of Ezekiel.
Mm-hmm. Our mind is called back to Ezekiel with the wheels and the fire. We're given the language of purity, the whiteness.
He has a throne.
Sitting on a throne?
Revelation.
The books were open. Revelation.
Yeah, so Daniel is a helpful study for studying Revelation. It's pretty clear already that Revelation draws heavily on this imagery here.
Innumerable people. I mean, you can't.
Countless people serving him. Lots of power. We're sitting on the throne. We've got countless people before him. There's purity with the light. What does fire symbolize?
Purity.
purifying judgment, and even holiness you can throw in there, calling back a few quarters ago. But fire comes along with God, and there's the purifying nature and things like that. And so then the throne room becomes a courtroom, and books are opened. What does that lead to? We open books, and then what happens?
The beasts come back.
The beasts come back. But what happens with the beasts?
Judgment.
They are judged.
Immediately.
The fourth beast is killed. The great, terrifying one that we can't even liken to anything we've ever seen. This horrible, terrible thing that's, you know, seems as if it's stronger and greater than the others. Killed and given into the fire. Taken care of. Now, I'm going to level with you. I don't totally know what to say about the extension of life granted to the other three. But, either way, their dominion is taken away. So, even if they're still around, they don't have the same effect, the same power. They can't do the same stuff anymore. You know, they're put in a cage and you can look at them and yeah, they're still there, but they're not going to come bite you anymore. And so what does this add to the vision as a whole? Like at that point, at the end of verse 12, what has this added now?
Those kingdoms weren't quite as scary as they sounded to start with.
Yeah.
Taken care of pretty...
So the things look bad with the beasts. It looks terrible. We're toast. But then the Ancient of Days shows up. It's no big deal. Things are good. He's got this taken care of. Judgment has happened. It's just. The biggest, baddest one is taken away and thrown away. The others are locked up. Hope. This gives hope. Even when it looks terrible, the Ancient of Days comes. There's hope.
I just want to, since we've already invoked Revelation, the same thing happens in Revelation.
Yeah.
You get these big armies together for the Battle of Armageddon, and then it's over.
Yeah.
It's like, it's almost comical in the way that it's like, and the beast was thrown down into the pit, and it's done. It's like,
yeah.
Oh, okay.
All of the terror that went on before is defeated with just, you know, one short little line. And then we get to verses 13 and 14, which it seems odd to me, but these verses are the headwaters of a river of ink. There's so much wrangling that goes on over 13 and 14, but maybe I'm obtuse, but this seems relatively obvious to me. What do you see here? What do we make of this one in verses 13 and 14?
Well, maybe not 13 and 14, but just kind of the whole thing with
yeah.
Specifically the beasts being locked away. I'm seeing it as evil's going to have its day, but you know, this is prevalent all the way to today.
Yeah.
It's going to go away.
Yep. Thank you. So, the one like a son of man, what do you make of him?
Yeah, there's a really strong connection to what Jesus already did, what he's fulfilled.
So it's Jesus just comes off the page at us, but others believe that this has something to do with angels or the embodiment of the saints. So there are other ways to read this. I don't get it. I don't see it. But I'm just telling you, it's out there. Like I told you before, I'm warning you about some of this. Because like if you look at the page on Wikipedia for the book of Daniel, it gives you the late date. The skeptical date, not the date that we established last week. Just be warned. He comes riding on the clouds. What does that tell you about this person?
He's out of our league.
He is out of our league. That is one way of putting it. As far as Scripture is concerned, only God rides clouds. And as far as the real world goes, only God rides clouds.
Well, Jesus ascended into the clouds to go to God.
Right.
Which is exactly what that's saying.
Yeah. So like in Psalm 104, he lays the beams of his upper chambers in the waters. He makes the clouds his chariots. He walks upon the wings of the wind. Then he makes his winds messengers, flaming fire his ministers. So, only God walks on clouds. The vehicle cloud is coming down, and we get a glimpse of the person in the driver's seat. And it's one like a son of man. What do you know about that phrase, son of man?
It's how Jesus refers to himself.
So this is Jesus' favorite way to refer to himself. So that really helps with this vision. But
it's also how Ezekiel is referred to.
Yeah. So in the Old Testament, 99% of the time that phrase gets used, it is just a poetic way of referring to a mere human. In fact, that calling Ezekiel a son of man is almost a way of emphasizing his humanity and his mortality. You're just a son of man. And so
God gives him all authority.
Right. And so it's easy to see how Jesus fits right in here, but thinking about the people who read this for 400 years between when Daniel wrote this and when Jesus came along, we've got somebody doing something that only God does, but it looks like human. So and he's like a son of man because he is a son of man, we know from Jesus. And even though now, knowing Jesus and his story, he has ascended to the right hand of God, he's still a son of man because the body went with it.
I feel a connection back to the first section, too. We had all of these beasts that it's too big for you to understand. You're not going to get it. But it's kind of like this thing that you're familiar with. And here we get one coming who is too big, you're not going to get it, but think man-ish, mm-hmm. somewhere in that vicinity.
Yeah.
And that kind of changes the way that phrase gets used.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So all that was to sort of stir you up, because the son of man is a pretty familiar phrase, but that's a loaded term. There's a lot in that.
So just what might emphasize that more, like that means human, or like very specifically human,
yeah,
is with that authority part, where the fact that it has to be specific and say they were given authority would imply the opposite is the normal.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise you wouldn't have to say they had this thing, everyone just knows it.
Yeah, with the authority, if it's given, it's not inherent there. So, and so this Son of Man is made ruler over an eternal kingdom. And again, we're comfortable with that language and the connections to Jesus and his church. We get that. But how does that piece fit into the vision? Put it in the context. What's the power of this scene after what has just happened?
Well, it's the same as in the statue vision. It's the stone at the end.
Yeah.
It's eternal kingdom.
Yeah. Thank you.
You have the appearance in these four beasts of great power, everlasting dominion, but that's not the form that it ultimately is going to take, right? It's going to be this Son of Man that's going to have dominion over all creation, which is in and of itself a return to Eden.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that God always wanted it to be, where men had dominion over the beasts, and yet from our sin, from our curse, in many ways beasts had dominion over us because they caused great terror. Now it's all set right again.
Yeah.
I think part of it too is that we had these big scary beasts at the beginning of the chapter. And God, the Ancient of Days, is like, oh, look, an ant, and squashes it.
Yeah.
But then we have this one who just looks like a guy, but he's the one who gets eternal dominion.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one who gets it forever.
Yeah. So early in the chapter, we have what looks like power and dominion and might, and, makes you shake in your boots. Hold on a minute. Just let God do his thing, and you'll see. The real power and real dominion belongs to this Son of Man.
And many will succumb to that. Many will bow down to these beasts and follow them, just like in Revelation, the mark of the beast. So if you persevere to the end, the true power, the true kingdom will come.
Right. And so it's visions like this that encourage people to not bow down and give in to the beasts at the, on the front end, because when you're given this sort of vision, you see how all that comes out, that if you bow the knee, you know, to the wrong thing, it's going to work out poorly for you too, because the true power and dominion is coming with Jesus.
Hunter, I noticed that there's a contrast with this. The Son of Man is—it's all so peaceful, mm-hmm. as opposed to that violence of those four beasts before. And I think that's also—it's not stated as such, but it's in there in the language, the way it's poetically stated.
Yeah.
There's chaos with the beasts, and they're all over the place, and they've got bones in their mouths. I think things are being ripped off, but this is, he's beautiful and peaceful, and his presence and his glory, his kingship, there's a contrast there.
Yeah, so the picture of the beasts on the sea is way different than the picture of the Ancient of Days sitting on a throne, being served by people, and the Son of Man coming to him and being given this authority. And he rules and can maintain peace, and there's not going to be any more attacks from the beasts because the Son of Man has the ultimate authority and can deal with all of that.
It reminds me, what you said reminds me of Jesus walking on the water.
Mm-hmm.
And so Peter takes his eyes off of Jesus, and he sees the chaos of the water, and he begins to sink.
Mm-hmm.
But Jesus says, you know, keep your eyes on me, because I have all authority. God has given me all authority. I'm over all of this chaos.
Yeah.
And if you'll bow to me and not to Satan,
mm-hmm.
not to all of this garbage that's around us, then it gives us hope. It gives us peace.
Yeah.
Because we see God in heaven, and he's taking care of all of this,
mm-hmm.
and now it's time for Christ to reign eternally, because it talks about everlasting dominion and his kingdom, one that shall not be destroyed.
Yeah.
And that, with all that they've been through with Nebuchadnezzar and in Babylon, and
mm-hmm.
it gives these people who will listen,
yeah.
have the ear to hear,
mm-hmm.
it gives them hope,
yeah.
that okay, I'm doing the right thing.
Yeah.
I'm where I need to be.
The amount of hope that would be given to a people who had just been conquered and carted out of their homeland, the amount of hope this would give to say that he's going to be set up, it's going to be forever, and you're never going to be carted out of the land, you know, out of the land again. That's tremendous. Let's keep going. We need to finish the chapter. Verse 15. As for me, Daniel, my spirit was distressed within me, and the visions in my mind kept alarming me. And so I approached one of those who were standing by and began asking him the exact meaning of all this. And so he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. The great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings who will arise from the earth. But the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, for all ages to come. Then I desired to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its claws of bronze, and which devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and the meaning of the ten horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up, before which three of them fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth uttering great boasts, and which was larger in appearance than its associates. I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the highest one. And the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. Thus he said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms, and will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. As for the ten horns, out of this kingdom ten kings will arise, and another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones, and will subdue three kings. He will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the highest one. And he will intend to make alterations in times and in law, and they will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. But the court will sit for judgment, and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the highest one. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all the dominions will serve and obey him. At this point, the revelation ended. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts were greatly alarming me. My face grew pale, but I kept the matter to myself. What's Daniel's reaction to all of this?
What does it mean?
He wants some explanation. What else?
Seems pretty much just overwhelmed.
He's troubled. And he wouldn't ever get the clarity of hindsight that we have to look back and see how this really worked out. Now, remember where we started in verse 1. This vision comes in the first year of Belshazzar, which would put us in the 550s B.C. Do you remember when Daniel was carted off to Babylon? Do you remember the year?
720?
Six.
605. So, it has been more than 50 years that Daniel has been in Babylon now before he's given this vision. Remember, Daniel's an old man now. He's seen a lot. But he's still quite distressed about this. Now, remember what David was saying this morning, like sometimes the seasons will last a long time. And we talked about the hope that we get out of this vision and that they could get out of this vision. He's been an exile in Babylon for 50 years before he gets this. So the message is, hang in there. Sometimes it takes a while. And maybe that's because he needed the maturity of age to be able to handle the weight of such a vision of what's coming in the future.
And sometimes it gets more terrifying before it starts getting hopeful.
Sometimes it gets worse before it gets better.
It was bad, and then it got real worse one night.
Yes.
Well, not only that, it's still the first kingdom. He's still in the first kingdom, and he's aligned with the first kingdom. I mean, he's like number three in the first kingdom. I mean,
yeah.
If the second kingdom is about to be coming, he may have a personal reason to be alarmed.
Yeah. So, interesting things to note with the timeline here. And then, so we get some angelic interpretation of the scene. And, I approached one of those who were standing by. I guess that's one of the thousands that were serving the Ancient of Days. Whoever this is, some sort of, angelic, I guess, interpreter, says that we're talking about kings. But that language can be confusing. Because, he says there's four kings, but we're actually talking about more than four kings. We're talking about four kingdoms, because when we come back in verse 23, he calls it a kingdom this time. And can't have a king without a kingdom, can't have a kingdom without a king. So you can sort of interchange them, but there's more than four kings involved in this thing. But four kingdoms. What do you notice about this initial explanation that he's given in 17 and 18?
Skips over three of them.
It's awfully short, isn't it? I want to know what all this means. And the great beasts are four kings, but the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and all for all ages to come. Kind of wanted a little more, right? And he does ask for more. But the first explanation is really short, and it ends in hope again. So don't stray far from verse 18 when you're trying to figure, when you're working with all the confusing details. Don't stray far from 18, because that's where the explanation comes back to every time. The beasts are going to be dealt with, kingdom forever. It's going to be okay. But there is some stuff in between, and this explanation helps us some, but trying to line things up with history, there are still a few challenges. There are some varying views here that the traditional, and in my opinion, the very most likely, is that the first beast is just like with the statues, Babylon. Second, the Medes and the Persians together. Some people try and split that apart to fiddle with the date stuff, again, like we talked about. The third would be the Greeks, and the fourth would be the Romans. And the Romans, you get this, you know, list of emperors that we can line up and get to 11, which ends with Domitian, who was a great persecutor of Christians. But there's all sorts of other ways of viewing this, but that's okay. What's the lesson of the vision now that you've seen the whole thing?
God's in control.
It's the same message as the whole book. God's in control. God's in control.
Be in the room.
Hammers it home time and time again in all sorts of different ways. But, you know, we said the whole point is of the book, God's in control, God reigns. But these visions add some nuance and depth to that that can help us with that. God does allow it to get bad sometimes. Why?
Distraction.
What do you mean?
Well, when it gets bad, you start worrying about the wrong things.
Hmm. Okay.
Test. Yeah, it's for purification. It's to get the real folks who are fully committed.
Get to the real. So it's the stuff we talked about at the beginning with the vision itself. But the stuff, the way the vision works. But the vision itself can teach us the same point again too. And so when Peter writes in the days of the fourth beast in 1 Peter 1, thinking, you know, this fourth great beast with the iron teeth and the bronze claws, which was added the second time we're introduced to the beast. Peter writes this in 1 Peter 1, verse 6. In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials. Fourth beast. So that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And though you have not seen him, you love him. And though you do not see him now, but believe in him, you greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, obtaining as the outcome of your faith the salvation of your soul. Peter does the same thing, teaches us the same thing, or the pattern is the same with Peter as it is with Daniel. It gets bad, but the outcome can be the same if we let the testing do its work. You can just be crushed by the beast and that be the end of it. But it doesn't have to be that way. Because God, like David said this morning, is with his people through these things. And remember too then, from these visions, that the wicked treatment of God's people is always going to be limited. It will never go unchecked because God is with his people. All of the beasts are eventually cast down. And yeah, there's some details in the back half of the chapter, like with the time, times, and half the time, which comes up to three and a half, which is half of the perfect number, seven. It's cut off. Whatever you do with the visions. You know, one of the commentaries I was reading said that it makes little difference as to the actual interpretation or meaning of the word. And in a practical sense, that's only academic in its implications. It's neat to see the Babylon and the Medes and the Persians and the Greeks and the Romans. That's good. But the point is the same. Because like Jeff says, it's always Babylon out there. And the pattern holds true through history. Even though what we may interpret as the fourth beast of this vision has been cast down, that doesn't mean we're exempt from the lesson and the message of this. Because even though the fourth beast is gone, surely there could be a fifth and a sixth and however long until the end of time. But the message remains the same. It can and will get bad sometimes. But that's okay, because God never abandons his people. Never. abandons his people. And the wickedness is always going to be limited. It will never go on forever. And God will always win in the end. Thank you for a good class.